Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Oh, we have Russell Edwards, author of Naming Jack the Ripper, and I'm glad you can join us tonight.
Thank you very much, Al. It's a pleasure.
So how you been doing? It sounds like you've been real busy.
Yeah, it's 2 months now since the release of the book, and, you know, we've not slowed at all. The momentum's still there. the phenomenal response we've had from the world, really, you know, it's been extremely positive. We're very happy, of course.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I mean, you must feel good that you've kind of solved something and you weren't sure that you were going to do it, you know, and it just sort of happened. That's great, eh?
Yeah. It's. I mean, I must admit, 3.5 years that's an English word for just schlepping up to the northwest, about 250 miles every week to see Dr. Jari Lohelainen in his lab, working with him for 3.5 years to make sure we've absolutely nailed every single angle we could. You know, not knowing if we were going to get the real results, you know, or not. And then when we did get the results, it was just truly phenomenal. The response has been overwhelming.
Well, that's good. That's good. So now for the people that haven't, who don't know you, let's start out with who you are and what you sort of have done with your life before this. Like, so what, who are you and where do you come from and what do you kind of do?
Sure. Well, I'm Russell Edwards. I was born in the Northwest. My accent is not far from Liverpool. So obviously everybody thinks that I'm from the same place as the Beatles, you know, which we truly love. We truly love our city. We were in the 60s, they had the Mersey Beat. So very much influenced the musician that I used to be in my former years. Really a businessman. Property is my passion, architecture. That's really where I started. Came down south to Cambridge about 25 years ago, then got a place at a college in London, and that's really where the introduction to the City of London started for me back in 89. Then I got introduced to the East End of London, and of course it's just an overwhelmingly brilliant place to be, in my opinion, and so many other people's opinions, you know, that you sort of get hooked into just the whole culture of that place. It's sort of like a street level cool, if that's, you know, if you can understand that.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, obviously I'm a very happily married man. And I've got two beautiful children, who I adore, who are just very proud of the dad, of what he's just done. And I just got interested in this story about 14 years ago, really because it's so linked within I would say 100 yards of where I've been for 11 years, through my various businesses that I've done. And that's really a little bit about me in a nutshell, if you like.
Yeah. So that was architecture. So that's a good place to be, London, eh?
Oh, it is. I mean, you know, I'm constantly doing stuff on Twitter and Facebook of just how beautiful the architecture of this city is. I mean, I was in Stonehenge yesterday doing the same thing. But, you know, we've got some wonderful cities across America, you know, same over there. It's just have this eye for beauty and buildings. It's, you know, people actually really cared about what they presented on this, you know, all those years ago. And again, Paris is another one of my favorites. It's just the city of love, and anybody that can ever get the chance or take time to go there, it's just overwhelming with beauty. You just, you know, it's fabulous. Of course, autumn with the turning of the color of the trees, you get this lovely color. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, they're both lovely cities. I've been to both. They're great. I think that, you know. Do you have a favorite building or something that you just love above all?
Again, it's a bit like saying what's your favorite film. You know, it depends what mood you're in. I've just been at Bank today taking photos of the Stock Exchange and all the different architecture that's loomed over now by the new buildings, all these glass skyscrapers that seem to be just sprouting up in the city. Of course, you've got Big Ben, which whenever anybody sees Big Ben in real life, the first thing they say is actually quite little.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah. But, you know, it's just everything, really. There's just too many splendid places to sort of name one, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. I just...
Yeah.
So now let's start with what brought you into Jack the Ripper?
Yeah, well, as I said, I came down to London really in at the autumn of 1989.
I was going to say.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I do feel it today, I tell you. And really, it was going down the bagel shops, which is like this 24-hour bagel bake at the north end of Brick Lane, which is in the East End. Again, just passionately fell in love with the area, with all the colours, the smells of the curry houses. And that sort of, it was like a, if you like, a spiritual home for me. And I used to take, when we did set up our businesses, we used to take all our corporate clients down there because it's so colourful, you know, with all the bright lights and just the different cultures down there. And then I watched this film From Hell with Johnny Depp. I mean, obviously so many tremendous actors were in that film, but most people identify with Johnny Depp. And then I wondered where, you know, where did he kill all these people? Was it a myth? Is he like Dracula and Frankenstein? And then lo and behold, I realized, no, there was a serial killer. He did murder these women, and these were real people. And I realized, at that point, I realized, you know, this is a true unsolved mystery. And that's really where it started, you know?
Yeah. So that was... So now, how long did it take you to get through? Like, it seems like it took you a number of years to get this book together.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, we go back, the love of the East End for me is now 25 years. I've been interested in this story. For the first 6 years, it wasn't like a morbid obsession at all. I just like a passing interest and just thought I'd have a little go and see if any, you know, play Hunt the Ripper like so many people do and have done over, what is it now, over 126 years. And then when I managed to buy this shawl, which I'm sure we'll come on to, that's really when the true story started. So in answer to your question, it's been about 14 years, 14 and a half years now.
Wow. That's a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
So now you started researching. What was the first thing that you were doing? Like you were going to the areas, you were searching out. And let's tell people about what was it like back then? So... The crime scene itself, back then police, how did they handle a crime scene?
Okay, so if we go back to Victorian London, if you can imagine, we're going back to 1888. There was no sophistication like there is in modern day police work. So a murder victim would be discovered. She'd be taken to the mortuary. invariably all the evidence would be destroyed and burnt because, of course, there was no DNA, no forensics, fingerprint testing in very, very early days. So really, the crime scenes were washed down with buckets of water and everyone got on with their daily life. And back then, unless you got an identification or a confession, you were never going to get a conviction.
Wow. So it made it quite a bit tougher.
Yeah.
So how many murders were, for the people that don't know, which is probably hard to believe, but I guess there are, how many murders did Jack the Ripper get associated with?
Yeah, well, over a two-year period at that time, there were 11 murders, five of which were attributed to the myth of Jack the Ripper because of the MO, the way he actually conducted the murders.
Yeah. So now, were they, who were these people that were murdered? Were they average citizens? Were they workers? Or what were they?
Well, these poor ladies were, you know, lots of people just call them prostitutes, but really they're called unfortunates. And these are women that had fallen from grace, if you like, that had regular lives. Something happened to them at some point in their lives, and they fell on very hard times, became, you know, heavy drinkers, alcoholics. I'd say alcoholics, that's too strong a word. They're more dependent on just getting through a very harsh life, living a day-to-day, daily existence, trying to get some money whichever way they could, you know. And at the end, if they, you know, if they weren't selling flowers or thimbles or matches, a bit like Eliza Doolittle back in My Fair Lady, then they would have to sell the bodies for, you know, 4 pence to pay for the room for the evening. But they really did live a daily existence. And back then, there was about 1,200 of them in the Whitechapel area.
Wow, so it was pretty common. It wasn't...
So
what was the mentality? I guess they weren't treated very well in common society.
Absolutely not. At the time, you know, at the end of the 19th century, it was, you know, England had the Commonwealth, Victorian Britain, Queen Victoria. They say Britain ruled the waves. And there was one little part of London where really it was the vice den, if you like, which was Whitechapel, very violent. There was these things called high rip gangs, which are these guys that used to go and bully these poor women and just take whatever farthings, coppers, whatever they had on them. You know, it was just a very, very grueling, hard existence. And then just on to sort of compound this, it was such a, well, Whitechapel's such a city, an area of flux. So, of course, Poland was under Russian rule at the time. And the poor people of Poland had to flee their own country. So families would just give up their whole lives just to start again because it was so terrible for them. So there was only two places to go, really, which was Whitechapel or New York. So, and that was it. So you had a huge influx of people looking for a new home. And it was, they set up their homes in Whitechapel. So you had this whole huge amount of anti-Semitism going on at the same time as well.
Right. So they weren't treated very well, I guess. If you're living in that area in the Whitechapel, and you're people didn't treat them very well. So I'm trying to get to. So I guess the cops didn't really care that they were being killed, or did they?
Oh, of course they did. Yes, this was. I mean, this is exceptionally uncommon. You know, it was one thing, the huge amount of work they had to do just keeping it at bay, if you like, Whitechapel at bay. But really, yes, they took this very, very seriously, the police at the time. Remembering, we're looking at 1888, and the police force was set up by Sir Robert Peel only in 1829. So, you know, even though it was still there, it was sort of still in its infancy of learning the procedures and the strict rules of what they had to adhere to. You know, but yes, they did take this exceptionally seriously at the time.
What do you think the big curiosity is about this? I mean, so long now, and people still talk about it, and it's still, they can still make movies about it, and people are still very involved. Is there something particular about this case?
I think it captures all the romance of what people imagine of the Victorian era. I mean, even if you look at pictures of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde, Oscar Wilde got the inspiration for that story by visiting the opium dens down in Whitechapel himself. You know, so it's this history, you've got this old, you know, this Victorian era, then you've got this mythical character, Jack the Ripper. So people identify that this is just this fantasy, you know, this specter, if you like, that's not really existent, like I did when I first started. But then when you realise there was a serial killer brutalising these women in a most terrible way, you know, which is what sparked it for me, was, you know, surely somebody should be bringing this guy to justice. But that's this thing. It's this unsolved mystery. It's whodunit. You know, I've always said it is a whodunit of whodunits. You know, no one's been able to actually finally, you know, point a finger at this guy until I came along and had something forensic to once, you know, for once and for all, put the story to bed, if you like.
Yeah. Now, so you've been there and been in the area. Can you still feel it? Can you still feel all that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You really can, especially in the evenings when, you know, when the twilight falls and you get in the dark, starts looming in. It has this amazing sensational feeling. It's very hard to describe. But what I can tell you, there's only about four streets left with these amazing Georgian buildings that were built about 1729. And you have this chill. Even in the summer, there's this chill when you walk around it with the old street lights. Very amazing place to be, you know. But yeah, there is something there, yeah.
So, I mean, we'll just go off a little. Do you believe in the afterlife or ghost, or do you think any of that's existing there?
I don't know if it's there. I mean, you know, I'm very open to more than what we know. Let's just put that way. I went to visit a place called Borley Rectory only last week, which is meant to be the most haunted house in Britain. Just this imagined ethereal plane that obviously exists. To those that believe, I should imagine, you know, I think there's more out there, I think. But, you know, who am I really to say there is or there isn't? But
yeah,
you know.
Well, I mean, you can, it's what we feel. I mean, that's what is.
Yeah.
I think, so do you think there's some residual effect there? Do you, like, feel the terror or feel the...
Well, not the terror so much. I mean, again, if you ever visit these lovely churches in and around the area, it has, again, that spiritual feeling, because it's sort of, encapsulates so, you know, generations of hundreds and thousands of years of people going to share their, you know, their praying, and it just has this spirit, and Whitechapel does have this spirit, this buzz, this draw, if you like, to people that come and visit it without actually realizing, and once they get there, they, you know, most people walk away thinking, wow, yeah, I've seen and experienced Whitechapel.
Okay, so now let's get into the actual killings. So, do you think that all the killings were done by the same person then?
Of the five, yes. I do. Very similar. I mean, you know, again, they're called the canonical five. The MO, the way he murdered them, is the same. Far better ripperologist than I, you know, it's very clear that these are very vicious, they escalated with violence. I mean, we're only one day, yesterday was the date of the anniversary of the very last murder of the Ripper, which was that of Mary Jane Kelly. You know, he murdered these poor women in a very specific way. The violence towards them escalated. It was only a 10-week period. So, yeah, five of these 11 Whitechapel murders, yeah, were definitely down to him.
So what was the specific way that he killed them that was unique to him?
Yeah, I mean, really, the way that I not always explain it is that, so just excuse me a second. What it is he used to throttle them or strangle them. He then used to cut the throat. He then used to mutilate them. He would disembowel them. He would take the uterus. On the fourth murder victim, he also took a uterus and her kidney. On the fifth victim, he stole a heart. A very vicious vicious, violent serial killer.
Do we know what he did with the body parts or the things that he took?
Well, again, you know, this is down to speculation. I ask, why would you take a woman's uterus? What would be the significance of that? And again, I've tried to avoid in my book any speculation or theory, but why would you? It's a very why take a body part? Why are these trophies? You know, most serial killers keep trophies of the victims, but in this case, they were body parts. And I mean,
did they ever find any of these pieces?
Thank you for asking that. Well, on the 16th of October in 1888, there was this gentleman called George Lusk, who was the head of what they call a vigilance committee. Just like these guys, that all shopkeepers, that all banded together to try and go out to patrol the streets to protect these unfortunate women. Now, George Lusk, he got a letter, and it was entitled From Hell, and that's the only Ripper letter that wasn't signed Jack the Ripper. And he also got half a kidney that was supposed to be taken by Catherine Eddowes. So, yes, he says in the letter that he ate half of it, and then he posted the other half to this man called George Lusk. So that's the only, you know, the only body part from the Ripper himself that was ever, you know, ever presented back to the world, really.
Wow. That's amazing. So now you what was the first break for you in the case?
Yeah, well, that was actually going back to 2007 in the March, when a shawl came up for sale at auction that was purported to be taken from the body of the fourth murder victim, Catherine Eddowes. And again, you know, it was a case of, well, what a massive claim, but with no scientific real analysis done on it. And I thought, well, if there was something tangible, then this was it. This would be the only piece of remaining evidence to this enigmatic mystery, to the legend of Jack the Ripper. And that's really where this story where we are today starts. Of course, when I bought it, I'm not a scientist or a researcher. I certainly wasn't back then. I had a passive interest or a passing interest in the story. And I thought, you know what, if I could, you know, one day prove the identity of this murderer through this, or at the time, just prove that this came from the case, I thought that would be a phenomenal finding. Of course, little did I know, 7.5 years later, here we are with the actual conclusive proof who Jack the Ripper was.
Yeah, that's me. Okay, on that note, let's just take another break, and we'll be back after this commercial. So now you went and you got this shawl, and how did you start, like, how did you process the evidence? Like, so who did you take it to get it,
Yeah. Well, to be honest, everybody thinks with things like CSI, you can just take a piece of evidence and prove it in minutes. It didn't work like that.
No.
I didn't know where to start it. Remembering that it's old DNA, so it's not fresh, so I needed to find an ancient DNA specialist. I then got told that I could find a descendant down the female line of one of these murder victims to match. It's one thing getting DNA off the shawl, but then another thing to actually match it with anybody. And all of these things back then were very, very huge things for someone like me to do. And it took me nearly over 3.5 years to find the right guy who was prepared to cooperate with me to basically undergo this voyage that I've been on. I think one of the most, for me, one of the days for me, was when I took it to him in his lab, let him scientifically work on it for the day, and he came back to me and said, look, all of this here, all these spots on this shore, which you can see with the naked eye, is arterial blood spatter in the form of slashing. So someone's had their throat cut, and the arterial spray from that is all over this shore, and this is where it all is. And this clot that's on the shore, that looks like it's from a body, you know, it's a body part. There's other bodily fluids on there, and I was like, wow, this could be it. And that's really where I got hooked.
So what did you do next? So how could you tie that to the murder?
Exactly. So the thing is, it was if this had come from the fourth murder scene of the Ripper, it had to be placed there. And the only way to do that, to see if the blood matched the descendants of Catherine Eddowes. So then I had to find a great-great-great-granddaughter who had come from down the female line. So that means Catherine Eddowes' daughter had to, you know, have a daughter, had to have a daughter, had to have a daughter. And that's the only way you could get a match. And that was really daunting. That took me a couple of years to find that. Again, not just that, I had to talk to this lady, her name's Karen Miller, who's been extremely supportive and exceptionally generous to me. And she gave me a DNA sample. And after a year's worth of intensive analysis, Dr. Jari Lohelainen, in his the techniques that he used, managed to get that match. Now, of course, we had to avoid contamination issues. So it wasn't a surface sample. It was actually taken from the weave in the fabric because the blood had embedded in there. And then again, thinking it was Catherine Eddowes' shawl and not anybody else's, we then had to date the shawl. And to date the shawl so that to make sure that it was in existence before or at the time of the murders, again, was a huge, massive piece of work. So I went to the experts, what we call in England the V&A Museum, Victoria and Albert Museum, the specialists there, Sotheby's and Christie's, who have specialists in their own rights. I went to a place called the Huguenot Society, and they represent the French silk weavers that used to live in Spitalfields and Whitechapel before the murders, you know, back in the 17th century and the 18th century. All of these people helped me along my way, and then a silk expert in Switzerland. So I did, you know, really did embark on this massive odyssey, if you like, to get to the answer of this. And then when all these guys did predate it, they more or less 1815 to 1835. We then took it to a scientist who used mass spectrometry, who then identified the dye to come from northern Russia. And the five experts, they said, well, actually, you know what? It's not British. Then all of a sudden I realized he took it with him. The murderer took it with him to the murder site. It wasn't Catherine Eddowes' shawl at all. So then that really raised the bar, because then whatever bodily fluids we could find on there that weren't Catherine Eddowes could have come from the murderer. So then we were gripped, and we found semen on the shawl. And then that was the massive thing for us, because what we've got now, we know that the murderer took this for a specific reason on that night when he murdered two women inside 45 minutes. He left his own bodily fluids on there, and there's this big sort of spine-chilling revelation that if we could match that with a descendant, then we've got the identity of Jack the Ripper. And that was where we were about a year ago. Then the thing is, Aaron Kosminski had not had any children. He was mentally ill. So we had to get the DNA from his sister and find, again, down the female line, a descendant who would cooperate and give us a DNA sample, which she did, thankfully, and then underwent, I think it was about a 10-month, really, really intensive set of scientific analysis, all through the genius of Dr. Jari Lohelainen. And then in February, sort of, you know, you can imagine that tense, nail-biting set of months where you don't get any sleep.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And then one night he said, "We've got a match." And that was just, yeah, that was...
That must have been pretty exciting at the time.
Well, at the time we were on, you know, this was top secret, as you can imagine. And only four people in the world knew we were doing this outside Yari and I. And it was 8:30 on a Friday night. And I couldn't get hold of anyone to share this with. And it was one of these things of just 7.5 years of intensive, you know, really racking your brain and everything you've got of your person, you know, your... It's the challenges, and then all of a sudden, it's been vindicated. We've proven it. We've got the identity of Jack the Ripper. And then when you want to tell the world, you just can't.
Yeah, hard in the day of communication, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, yeah, one of the most amazing experiences, I promise you, Al. It's been amazing.
I bet. So, now, the murderer... What can you tell us about him?
Yeah. Okay, well, the thing is, it was one thing. There's about 120, 130 suspects. Well, when I bought the shawl, I knew it would been it had been held in Scotland Yard's Crime Museum. So I contacted them. And thankfully, the curator at the time, a gentleman by the name of Alan McCormack, said there was a main suspect. He had been identified, but couldn't have been prosecuted because of Jewish religion, because he was Jewish and the witness was Jewish. So it was against their religion for the eyewitness to testify, which is I just recently found out that. But his name, Israel Swartz, the man that identified Aaron Kosminski, attacking the third murder victim minutes before she was found murdered. Scotland Yard, they told me that because of that, they couldn't arrest him. So they always had their main suspect, and Kosminski was named by the head of the investigation not long after the murders. So I had my main man, the suspect, the person to follow. So Aaron Kosminski was a Polish Jewish immigrant that came over with his family in 1881. So he'd had 7 years to learn the area. He was 23 at the time of the murders. He was incarcerated in Coney Hatch Asylum in February 1891. He stayed there for a few years and then was moved to Lewiston Asylum and died aged 54 in 1919.
Wow. So how did you tie him to the shawl?
Well, thank you for asking. This is it, you see. Yari and his... scientific exploration of this, a garment that we own, he managed to identify semen on the shawl. Then we had to make sure that if there was any cells in there, because we're talking, again, fragmented DNA, we're talking ancient DNA. You already did tell me, you know, you can go back 10,000 years and get DNA. So he said this, you know, it presents a challenge, but not one that's impossible. So he managed to get uncontaminated cell from those semen stains and gave it to a colleague of his who was what we call a sperm head analysis. And there's only three of those guys in the country. 3 months after, he managed to isolate cells from those sperm heads. And from those cells, we managed to get DNA, a DNA profile. From that DNA profile, we had to find a descendant for his Kosminski's sister, Matilda, and we did. And the DNA, again, this is sort of a 6 month, 8 month set of really intensive analysis. And it took us that long to actually get the match, but we got a match that was 100%.
Wow. So now you've tied it. So who did you tell us about Jari.
Dr. Jari Lohelainen, yes, he's a Finnish gentleman. He's been in the world of forensics for 30 years, has a vast amount of knowledge. He does work with Interpol. He heads up quite a lot of very fascinating subjects. So he's working on something to do with the Mary Rose, again, going back to Henry VIII's time. He's one of the consultants on a huge Roman dig. In a place called Chester, which is in the northwest of England, not far from where I am, where they've just found a burial ground with 1,500 Roman soldiers, which he's in one of the main consultants on as well. He's an associate professor in Helsinki. Molecular biology and forensics is his passion, his love. Again, a married man with two beautiful daughters, and been one of the most amazing allies, and now we've got our friendships just blossomed, as you can imagine, over the last few years. A very highly intellectual man that's been so understanding of me, a non-scientist. So when Jari explains some of the scientific work to me, he has to do it in layman's terms. And one of the funny things we always say is he explains something to me, I explain it back, thinking I've understood it. And he says, no, that's not it. But if that works for you, keep it like that. So it's just this one of these things that is just trying to, you know, different heads, if you like, and how we can sort of communicate and understand each other.
Yeah.
An totally amazing, different. Amazingly gifted scientist.
Where did you find him?
Yeah, well, we'd just out of the blue, I was asked to take part in a documentary a few years ago. And, that's where we, and so did Jari. And that's where we met. We met together. He was going to do some scientific work. Again, that's where we were really very happy to do the real work and not something just for TV, which was just superficial. He had about 15 minutes to do the TV work, really just for broadcast. And then I didn't understand back then it would take so long, which is, again, 3.5 years, to do, you know, a case and amount of work, something like this.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. What was the mental state, do you think, of the killer?
Yeah, well, when he was incarcerated in Coney Hatch Asylum, they gave him the title of Mania. His profession also was barber, and we know back then in Victorian London, barber also was a surgeon. So that's the surgical knowledge you're seeing. But the fact of mania, there was only that schizophrenia hadn't been given a title back then. So really, we're looking at a man who was paranoid schizophrenic, who had delusionary states, who heard voices, would only eat bread from the gutter. I would go for paranoid schizophrenia.
Did you come up with a kind of a cause of why he was killing all these women?
Yeah, so we go back a bit further. There's a amazing work being done with on this woeful affliction of schizophrenia over the years. A gentleman by the name of R.D. Lyne looked at schizophrenia in the family. And in a lot of cases, they're the precursor to symptoms of schizophrenia. We look back at Kosminski's life, and we know his father died at the age of 8. So there's lack of attachment, so there's only the mother figure. We know that his mum was 45 when she gave birth to Kosminski. And if you look at 4 of the 5 victims, that was about the age of the victims. So this is a lot of work. There's still a lot of work to be done. But we look at sort of, is there a bitter hatred of women through his mother? Because he was known as a misogynist, Kosminski. And we know that misogyny, a misogynist is somebody that has a bitter hatred of women. So you put all these factors into the mix. You've got a suspect, but then again, without the scientific work through the DNA, you would only have a suspect, and you wouldn't have somebody who you could convict. So you can see all of these things fit the puzzle of Kosminski, and then of course the DNA matches sort of the icing on the cake, if you like.
So what is it that you think that ties the shawl to him?
Well, this is it, you see. It came from Russia. I looked at Pavlovsky Posad, who were making shawls back then. He obviously, the pattern on the shawl was significant of three of the five murder dates. And he obviously took that with him to make that point, the point of Michaelmas, which is the Michaelmas Daisy pattern on the shawl, which goes back to newspaper records of the time, that Michaelmas is celebrated by the Christians and Orthodox Christians on the 29th of September, when he went out on the night of the 29th to look for a victim. He ended up murdering two. And the 8th of November, he left the shawl there to let the, to, in a very obscure way, which is I'm the only person that seems to have linked this, and Scotland Yard thanked me on that, that the 8th of September, 8th of November is the other date of Michaelmas, and he went out on the 8th to find a murder victim, and Mary Jane Kelly was found on the 9th, which happens to be 126 years ago yesterday. So it's a very cryptic clue, a message, and he let the police and the world know the date of the next murder, and it was. And for many, many years, in fact, 126 years, no one could understand why he murdered four women inside 4 weeks and then stopped and didn't murder one for a further 5 weeks. So this shawl was such a significant find just in that. But of course, we also look at the fact that semen on the shawl, and because he used to take the uteri of these women, you know, was it just a sadistic murderer? Well, actually, now we know semen was on there, we know it was his, that it also changes the motive. It was sexually driven. So the all these points are, you know, it's this revelation of all these things that have coming out just from the shawl.
And I guess the shawl couldn't have been the victim.
Well, this is it. There's two types of dye on there, and the rudimentary plant dyes, which predates 1856 through the science. If the shawl was taken outside in the rain, the dye would have washed out. We're extremely lucky that shawl's never been washed, because all the dye would have just run out. Dr. Fayez Ismail, that did all this, the dye analysis for us, said this shawl could only have been owned by someone of a middle-class background or middle-class family. And we know the Kosminski's family were quite very well revered and respected, successful tailors in Whitechapel at the time of the murders.
Wow. So, overall, how's the response been to your book?
Exceptionally well. There are those people that try and keep this a myth. There'll always be the non-believers. We've always said, if Jack the Ripper was alive today, handing one of these non-believers the bloodied knife and said, "I'm Jack the Ripper," they would still say, "I don't believe you." And there will always be these type of people. But on the whole, we've had such a tremendous response, you know, to the fact that we've solved this mystery.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Where do you see yourself going now after this?
Well, there's two more unsolved murders that Yari and I mean, you can imagine this journey of discovery that we've gone on. It's quite hard to leave it. We'd like to go and do another unsolved mystery, to be honest.
Wow. Can you tell us what you're looking at now?
Ah, there's two. There's one in England, not as notorious as Jack the Ripper, but still very big in English history. And then there's one in the US which is unsolved. And we'd like to have a try of that one, which will be sort of mid next year.
Well, exciting adventure.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So, what can you tell us about the back to the Jack the Ripper? What can you tell us that we're not hearing?
The Jack the Ripper is this myth that was spawned at the time of the murders and just stayed in the public psyche in a global way for over a century and a quarter. But actually, as I found out when I watched the film From Hell, this cloaks the fact that there was a serial killer that brutalized women in London at the time, and he was never brought to justice. And it was my endeavor to, and that's really what my motive behind all this, my endeavor to see if we could actually prove this conclusively once and for all. And thanks to the brilliance and of the scientific genius of Dr. Jari Lohalainen and my drive, if you like, to just keep this going until we get to a conclusion, we've managed to finally conclusively prove the identity of that serial killer. And the serial killer, you sort of got this myth, this fantasy, a bit like Dracula and Frankenstein, which is called Jack the Ripper, which really sort of overshadows this serial killer that we've now named as Aaron Kosminski.
Do you find that there's any good movies or any good programs out there that sort of represents what happened?
Yeah, well, again, the films that have come out all related to the Duke of Clarence, which is just not true. But the fact that if you imagine that Jack the Ripper could have been the prince of Queen Victoria or the son of Queen Victoria, you couldn't get a better suspect, if you like, and sort of bring, you know, the prevalence of the case to the fore. But really, you know, everybody has their own take on this. But really, if you look at again, From Hell, it's a great film. But again, it wasn't Sir William Gull, what is portrayed in the film. But it gives a good, strong representation of the violence and what the Ripper did back at the time of the murders.
So now when they did research on that, their own DNA and research, what makes yours more, let's say, more real, or makes you think that what you've done is more real than what they've done?
Thank you for the question, Al. Well, believe it or not, the only thing in existence is this shawl. All of these suspects are all on theory. There's no other DNA evidence. There is no other forensic testing. There's nothing. This is the only piece of evidence in history that's linked the Ripper to the murderer. You know, the real murderer, if you like. Everything else has been hearsay, and there's been nothing really tangible other than a really fantastic authoress, Patricia Cornwell, that did look at analyse the glue on the stamps of the Ripper letters to see if that was a way you could find Jack the Ripper. But even so, that only could have if that somebody wrote a letter, couldn't conclusively prove that whoever wrote that letter was the murderer. So, you know, an amazing lady, I'm being told, and some of her books are just extremely fantastic. She was the first lady to do any forensic work, but only from stamps. And that could only really say that they wrote, you know, the letters were written by whoever, but that's all really.
Do you think that ties them to someone? Like, why would someone write the letters?
Well, you know what? Lots of people wrote letters back then. For obscure reasons, which I can't really give you an answer to, but there were hundreds and hundreds of letters written at the time, all saying that they were from Jack the Ripper. But who knows? The only letter really is the From Hell letter, which, as I said before, that had half a kidney with it. But that disappeared. You know, nobody really knows if the one that's just turned up out of the blue all of a sudden is the real one. You know. But yeah. Really, again, even so, you'd have to go back to the kidney, which is gone, long gone now. You know, this is the only valid, tangible piece of evidence in history. And I should imagine, you know, that's what took me down this journey over 7.5 years and brought me to the conclusive conclusion, if you like. And there's never been anyone else to be able to do that in over 126 years.
Right, and that the stamp that they tested with DNA, now was that come out to be a woman or something?
Well, this is it, you know, I think it was the Openshaw letter, which is believed to be genuine, but it's only believed. And yes, the stamp again was reanalyzed only 3 years ago, and it turned out that the DNA on there was female, not male.
Yeah, so that's, kind of weird in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Again, this thing about throwing, you know, to obfuscate the story, really. But even so, if it was male and it was Patricia Cornwell's suspect, it would only prove he wrote that letter and not actually stood there and did the murders, you see.
Yeah, wow.
But even so, may I just say, the amount of effort to write a book, which I've only written one, To do something like this, and the conviction for all these amazing authors over the years has still managed to breathe life into this story.
Oh yeah, totally. A whole new thing. Now, I was going to say also, now in the shawl there is blood splatter and semen. Now, did it also have shapes or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's clear evidence of split body parts, which is exceptionally hard to forge, which is what Yari told me one January morning several years ago. Yeah, there's a clear clot. There's been a body part placed on there. And we know from the fourth murder that he did take Catherine Addo's kidney and her uterus.
Yeah, that's weird. Now,
it certainly is.
Do you see it going any further than this now? Is there any other avenues to pursue, do you think, with Jack the Ripper?
Of course there is. There should be a lot more work looking into the history of Kosminski. Mental illness is a very big topic. Why he murdered them in this specific way. I mean, they are a very specific ritualistic style of murders, which we know that's how you know that they're the same guy, and it was Kosminski. We did, Yari, about a year ago, we found a kidney cell amongst all those blood cells. So we want to go and analyse that because they have a certain shape. We could do eye colour. There is, but really, in anyone could bring a book out now and say, but the thing is, it would only ever be supposition. Again, you do need to match the blood. You've got to have blood and semen. You've got to have evidence. And thankfully, I have. I can't see where it could go from here, really.
Yeah. Now, that blood was tied to a relative of Kosminski, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah.
How was that? How did they take it?
The family of Kosminski, they all obviously know who he was, a suspect in the Ripper case. I think a bit of closure, really, to say this is, I met that person just after the story broke to explain everything, And yeah, overwhelmed, I think that's the word I could really give you, overwhelmed.
Yeah, well, it couldn't be a real thrilling thing to find out, but.
Well, as she did say to me, she certainly didn't do the murders.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah. I mean, it's no light on her. It's just
absolutely, yeah.
It must just feel, as you say, overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to take it all in, it one thing again, thinking or that he's just a suspect to actually be told it was him. It's quite a big thing to take in, really.
Oh, I bet. Well, this is certainly an interesting subject, and your pleasure to talk to.
Thank you, Alan.
Now, how can people get a hold of you if someone wants to write you or get a hold of your book? What's the best way to do it?
Okay, well, you can buy. I think the book's available online in Amazon, or in America, it's with Barnes & Noble. With me personally, I've got my own Twitter, which is at RipperTorLDN, or my website's www.thejacktheripperexperience.co.uk, and you can always link to me there.
Okay. I recommend highly getting the book, reading it. A very, very good read. And again, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And good luck in the future.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's been a real honor. Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Wave Media.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.